Hello again and welcome back. Our urban world is pretty much one of asphalt, concrete, and glass, but not too far away, the middle of the country is rich in prairie land, and that's important real estate for all of us. It's going to be subject of a discussion, a conversation, if you will, at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center this evening. The title is Let's Talk About Prairies, Conservation, and Energy. Two participants join me in studio. Dr. Peter Raven is an internationally renowned botanist and president emeritus of the Missouri Botanical Garden. Rudy Raceline is CEO of Raceline Associates and a prairie and wildlife restoration advocate. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
I think we'd better begin at the beginning, which is always a good idea, and tell people, Dr. Raven, I'll start with you, what exactly is a prairie?
Well, a prairie is the kind of grassland that occurs all over the world. It's perennial plants, usually mostly, that have interwoven root systems and very resilient, very burning prone, very grazing prone, and very fertile, and that was its problem.
How so?
Plowed up.
Plowed up, well.
Yeah, starting in the 1820s and 30s in the United States, with the advent of better plows and better opportunities for agriculture, much of our prairie was simply turned over into agriculture.
Are they protected in any sense, any of them?
Some of the few remaining ones are protected, but we have only about 0.1% of the original prairies in the state of Missouri left. So the bits and pieces that are protected, and people are actively trying to protect them, including my colleague here, Rudy, they're very few and far between.
Rudy, why are they important?
Well, I think what they provide is such a diverse abundance of different plants that serve both wildlife. They provide ecological services that we're just now starting to really understand. When you look at the major problems that we have with floods, we have problems with hypoxia in our rivers and streams. We have a loss of wildlife and birds that depend on this prairie and the diversity of this prairie. There are over 400 species of plants, of both grasses and forbs and legumes, that represented an abundance of both food and habitat for over 40 million bison, for millions of elk and deer and other habitat that we've lost. Missouri had over 17 million acres of prairie when our ancestors came here, and our Native Americans learned to use these prairies, and they used them in a way that provided a considerable amount of protein and habitat and roots that we're just now starting to learn about. And I think we could lose if we don't do something to promote the restoration and not only just preserve the small remnants that we have, but also promote a process of restoration. And I have a vision to potentially restore 30 million acres of prairie through a process where we could use some of that prairie as a biomass moving forward and actually gaining a source of energy from those prairies.
But if they're being plowed up now, isn't the toothpaste, so to speak, out of the tube in terms of the damage being done?
Well, I think the prairies that have been plowed up are certainly not something that you can restore and recreate in the form of a true prairie. But there are things that you can do that I have done and my son has helped me with on 1,650 acres in northern Missouri that we've seen the results in just a short 5 years, where we have abundance of quail, we have abundance of wildlife, and we have pure lakes and water. So there are things that we can learn from the existing prairies, and we can try to reconstruct. We can reconstruct in a way that gives us facsimiles. It will never give us the diversity of both below the ground and above the ground that a natural prairie has. But what's wonderful about what the Missouri Prairie Foundation and the Department of Conservation and the Nature Conservancy has done in preserving these remnants is they give us an insight into what we can do. And I think it's so essential that we protect the remaining prairies to give us a vision of what we can do moving forward to restore millions of acres that could be useful in many, many different ways, both to humankind and to wildlife and actually provide the ecological services that we so desperately need in the years to come.
Dr. Raven, this may seem like a strange question, and given what Rudy has just said, people listening here in St. Louis might be saying, okay, I get it, and I understand they need to be preserved, but how does it affect me? How do prairies affect me in St. Louis as I stand on my asphalt sidewalk or concrete sidewalk and in front of these concrete buildings?
Well, for that, you have to take a very broad picture. You know, my colleague Dan Jansen, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, inspired me about 40 years ago with this statement that the earth is a garden and we're all the gardeners. And prairie, in that very broad sense, is one of the many kinds of ecosystems and communities that we need to restore, that we need to put together into kind of a lasting general ecosystem in which we can live. About 1970, the Footprint Network website reported that we were using about 70% of the world's resilience, sustainable resilience. Now we're using about 156%. In other words, we're using more than there is. And in the biggest sense, what we have to do is put together a productive mosaic that will serve us and serve us sustainably into the future.
You know, one of the things that strikes me with the things that both of you said, the things that we have to do to preserve the prairie, the Native Americans actually got it, didn't they? I mean, they understood exactly how this whole system worked. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what we're learning from really studying what our Native Americans did, they also actually managed a prairie. In order to maintain a prairie, it needs management. It needs fire or it needs some kind of disruption. Otherwise, you go through a succession process where you start to grow herbaceous material or you start to grow trees. And we have that preponderance of that in northern Missouri where we see black locust trees, we see cedar trees, and we see many of these invasive plants that are actually even affecting our conservation reserve program, which made an attempt to put over 30 million acres back into a grassland. I think that program had a wonderful start, but it needs to be reviewed in terms of what species of plants were being planted and how it's managed. And one of the ways that it could be managed is potentially use a portion, maybe a third of it on a tri-semester basis, use some of that as a biomass. As an industrialist, I look at the questions to say, you know, the city of Des Moines is currently suing the EPA because of the amount of nitrates that are going into their water treatment facility. It's costing them over $1 million to remove those nitrates. Yet if we surrounded our streams and our rivers and our waterways with these deep-rooted systems, significant amount of that nitrate material would be absorbed by those plants and would have a very beneficial effect. And so how the city of St. Louis's effect is, we have two of the most wonderful rivers in the world, the Missouri and the Mississippi. Those waterways need to be protected. We can't continue to farm all the way up to the edge of these waterways without protecting them and having a buffer. And our native grass species, of which I said there was over 400, were very well adapted to that. They absorbed a considerable amount of the nutrients that were flowing into the river, and as they flooded, there was an accumulation system that was allowed to actually absorb these nutrients. And because of we use our rivers for navigational systems now, we've channelized those rivers. We've taken the accumulation systems that used to absorb much of the flooding out of the systems to where now we have these tremendous floods because we've eliminated accumulation systems that the prairies would be able to provide. An 8-inch rain was easily absorbed by our magnificent prairie systems. Now we have very short-rooted grass systems that can't absorb those kinds of rains. Or we have millions of acres in the wintertime that have no grass system or have nothing planted. And those things could be helped with cover crops that also are simulation of what our prairie used to do and provide root systems to absorb the water instead of it flowing into our waterways and, again, creating hypoxia and these problems that our municipalities have in absorbing those nutrients and getting them out so our kids and our grandkids aren't drinking that water with those nutrients.
It's very complicated, isn't it?
It is a very complex system. And the one thing I've learned, and Dr. Rabin has been a mentor, I'm an engineer with a background of engineering, but he's given me a lot of books about ecology. And so you learn that these things all have symbiotic relationships. We have one of the few relationships that don't give back. Most other plants and other organisms tend to develop these symbiosis relationships both below the ground and above the ground. And our native species took eons to develop those and to the point where they provide food for bugs and those bugs provide food for birds. And so there's this interrelationship that's existed that we've kind of broken. And when we look at, you know, why are we losing our pollinators? Why are we losing certain grassland species? It's all because we've broken that system and we have too much agricultural land that has to be sprayed and has to be cultivated in a way that does not support the kind of bugs that are needed for our grassland birds and many other species.
We are losing our pollinators, and Dr. Raven, I'll put this to you: this whole colony collapse in the bee world, is that having an impact on the prairies?
Well, it's having a general impact, but more particularly on cultivated crops. More than half of our food comes from crops that are pollinated by bees, and when it comes to something like almonds, they're all pollinated by honeybees that are brought in. 40% of all the hives in the United States are brought to almond groves in California when they're flowering. And the problem is, same is true of the apples in New York State, the problem is that without bees, you have no other way to get the job done. You certainly can't do it by individuals.
The poor almonds in California, there are no bees and now no water. And they need a lot of water to thrive, don't they?
Apparently 1 gallon per almond goes in before we get it, so I don't know what kind of a future they're going to have.
Part of what you're going to be talking about tonight deals with energy and the prairie. What is the connection between energy and our dilemma today with regard to it and the prairies?
Well, Rudy's the best one to talk about that, but channeled in the right way, prairie-like vegetation can generate lots of biomass, which can be harvested, you know, continuously from a resilient system to provide abundant sources of energy, which would be very important to us.
Switchgrass, that sort of thing, is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Well, switchgrass is just one of the species that can provide biomass. Again, from the studies that Dr. David Tillman and his associates, Dr. Clarence Lehman and Dr. Jake Younger, they've spent 20 years studying the biodiversity of plant life. And it's really them that inspired me to start thinking beyond monolithic plantings for biomass. The issue and what really brought me to the point in my life where I want to participate and not sit on the sidelines to see what's happening, there's the promotion of biomass the same way you look at crops, and that is how many tons per acre can you get? But we shouldn't think of it in terms of just amount of yield and tons per acre. It's what else is that particular plant contributing to the ecosystem? Is it providing a biodiversity for wildlife and for pollinators? Is it providing a sequestration of carbon dioxide? Is it providing a means of actually recharging our aquifers? Is it providing a filtration system for our streams and our rivers so that we have pure water? And if we can have all those things and a biomass and a source of biomass, even if that biomass doesn't yield the amount that some of the invasive species that are being suggested, or a single monolithic plant that's being suggested, society is going to be better off. And I got this vision when we used to maintain our prairies and we burned the prairies, and I saw the amount of energy that was going up and started looking into the amount of energy that a ton of grassland could provide. And the data that we've been able to put together is that an acre of prairie that yields about 4 tons could provide about 400 gallons, diesel equivalent gallons of compressed natural gas through a process called anaerobic digestion, which is a natural occurring process of organic decomposition of matter, and yielding methane. And that methane can be purified to give you the same molecule that you have in a compressed gas line. So the concept that we've tried to do is look at the low-hanging fruit. The low-hanging fruit really is manure from livestock, and combining that with a plant that will provide ecological services and benefits to wildlife at the same time. And as I said earlier, these plants need to be disrupted. They need to be burned. They need to be harvested. And so harvesting them in a way and at a time that benefits wildlife is what we're trying to put together so that we can actually promote an economic reason for farmers to plant these grasses other than altruistic reasons, which, you know, some people have the financial ability to do, but most people don't.
There's a pretty good response as to why people in the middle of an urban area should be thinking about why this is important to all of us. Dr. Raven, I heard on the radio the other day on NPR, talking about plowing up the prairies, that one of the big culprits right now are farmers who are planting corn because of ethanol. They found that this is a rich prospect for them.
Well, it's true, and it's not only the United States, but it affects the whole world because everything is so closely tied together. For example, peasants in Guatemala who usually depended on inexpensive imported corn from the United States can't afford it anymore, and they can't afford to grow it because all the lands they would have grown it on are occupied with corn being grown for biofuel. Just another example of the way we're all tied together. And also, it's important to bring out Cronin's book, Nature's Metropolis, which is about the growth of Chicago, is a beautiful illustration of the fact that cities don't exist on their own. Anybody who says, no problem with the tropics, Hong Kong and Panama City and all are gems of development, because they depend on many tens of times their own ability to produce in order to support themselves. So when you live in a city, no matter what you're thinking about as you look at the cars whizzing by on the street, you are dependent on farmland, resilience, and sustainability. And of course, that goes double in an age of global climate change when the ability to grow crops is becoming less and less. One of the important points that Dave Tillman and his colleagues, whom Rudy mentioned, brought out is that the more diverse a community is, the more diverse a prairie community would be, the more stable and resilient it will be, the more ability it has to resist strains and changes and pushes, and the more ability it has to stay there and keep productive. And I might also just throw in, so people are clear on this, when you talk about steppes in Europe, that's exactly the same as what we call prairies here. So the steppes of Hungary or something amount to prairie. We just call them prairie here. We use the French word because the French were the first ones to get here in big numbers.
So they got the chance to do the naming. What about climate change and its impact on the prairies?
Climate change is going to have a huge impact on everything, and we're all working very hard to try to get off the dime and begin to do something about it. One of the major problems with climate change is that people aren't going to change in any way that will impact them in the short run unless they have the ability to think more deeply about it. As your listeners may know, Pope Francis is going to issue an encyclical, that is an official statement on the environment and social justice, on the 18th of this month. And many of us have been working to try to provide the opening acts for that, because it's probably only a perception of social justice or a common shared issue, something like Earth Day in 1970, that would have the ability to make people think more deeply about the need to change.
I wanted to bring this up because Gene Ponzi, a previous guest whom you know well, mentioned that you've just come back from Rome, where you were working with the Vatican on this issue.
Yes, we had a. I've been a member of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences since 1990, and that's a body of 80 people selected for life, non-denominational, that advise the Pope about matters of science, technology, and the environment. And our colleagues there, and in the Pontific Twin Sister Institution, the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, have worked on this very hard starting in 2014. But the Pope on his own has always been deeply impressed, as are evangelical Christians, for example, with the fact that all these environmental problems affect the poor more deeply than they affect anyone else. And therefore, if we just go on tooling around in our cars and not thinking about it, we're doing something which really, in a broad sense, from a Christian point of view, is immoral. That's why we've worked on it so hard, and we'll continue to work on it.
Clearly, this is a very, very important statement he's going to make. And I'm gathering, without really being certain, unprecedented.
Well, the last few popes have all been interested in the environment and its effect on social justice. And in fact, what's been called the liberation movement, liberation theology in Latin America, is tied up with social justice. And basically, the more you wreck the environment, the more the poor suffer. And of course, in the second chapter of Genesis, it doesn't say go out and ream everything. It says care and preserve the earth in order to support yourself. In other words, in the sense of Dan Jansen, whom I quoted in the beginning, take seriously our responsibility as gardeners.
We are going to have to feed the world, and the world is going to have to be fed, and that's becoming increasingly difficult.
And we're all part of a system.
Yeah, yeah. Rudy, limited time left, but where do we go from here with regard to the prairie and conservation, preserving this ecosystem?
Well, I think the U.S. needs to take a leadership. I mean, as Dr. Raven said, I've had the good fortune. I'm an immigrant that came here in 1956. We had 150 million people. Today, 50 years later, we have 300 million people. As I've traveled to Nigeria and almost 40 other countries, most of those people want the same things we want, but they don't have the financial means. And if the U.S. doesn't take a leadership in providing a clear guidance towards, you know, sustainability and providing alternatives to fuel, who's going to do that? China is making an attempt. They've got over a million vehicles that are now running on compressed natural gas. They're taking a leadership in providing trees and reforesting their systems, understanding they have huge quality problems with their air and their water. And so I think the U.S. needs to take a leadership. And as an industrialist, what we're trying to do is provide a clean natural gas from animal waste and then also incorporate an economic approach for farmers to replant these grasses so that we can also use these grasses as biomass for natural gas.
Well, lots of work to be done, obviously. Needless to say, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and talking about this. It certainly is an eye-opener for me, and I'm sure for many of our listeners. A reminder that the Danforth Plant Science Center's Conversation Series presents Let's Talk About Prairies, Conservation, and Energy tonight at 6 at the Plant Science Center on Watson Road. That should be a most interesting session. Thank you, Dr. Peter Raven, for being with us. And Rudy Raceline, thank you so much as
thank
well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Have a good evening tonight. That's it for us for today. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk to members of Core Tango, that is, about performing tango music with a symphonic twist and their CD release concert. He'll also take a look at Emmeline, the fourth production in Opera Theater St. Louis's season, and he'll preview this year's St. Lou Fringe Festival. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with retired Air Force Colonel Michael Byron Smith about his new book of advice on fatherhood and being the best dad one can be. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Evita Caldwell, Aaron Dorr, Anya O'Connor, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.